This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley. Living through the early years of the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s is the subject of Thomas Mallon's diaries, which were excerpted in The New Yorker a few years ago. They are now collected in his new book, The Very Heart of It, New York Diaries 1983 to 1994. Mallon was in his 30s then and living in Manhattan. He was watching his boyfriend, friends, and fellow churchgoers get sick and die, leaving him in a constant state of anxiety over if and when he'd get his own death sentence. Mallon is best known for his historical novels. His latest, Up with the Sun, ends about where the journal excerpts begin. The novel is based on the life of a fairly obscure subject, Dick Kallman, a closeted gay actor in the 1950s and 60s who never quite made it. He was a part of Lucille Ball's Desilu workshop and co-starred in the Broadway musical 17. But after starring in a touring production of How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying and in a 1965 sitcom called Hank about the operator of a campus food truck, his roles dried up. Kallman went into the antiques business with Dolores Gray, who had starred in several movie musicals. In 1980, Kallman and his boyfriend were murdered in their Manhattan apartment by robbers, a murder that made the tabloids. Mallon also has written novels about Watergate, Nixon, and the couple who shared Lincoln's box seats at Ford Theater the night he was assassinated. Terry Gross spoke with Thomas Mallon in 2023.
Thomas Mallon, welcome to Fresh Air. You're such a good writer.
Thanks.
Why did you want to write about this actor Dick Kallman? I certainly had never heard of him before. I imagine most of the people in our audience have never heard of him either.
I used to watch his sitcom in 1965 to 66, which was the 1 year it was on. I was 13 years old at the time, and I desperately wanted to go to college. And
it was called Hank, by the way, for anyone who wants to know. Yeah.
The conceit was that he played a college drop-in. He didn't have the money for tuition, but he was desperate to get an education. And so he would disguise himself as other students, and he was always one step ahead of the registrar who was chasing him. It was sort of charming and preposterous. And I used to watch it, and he sort of stuck with me, and the program stuck with me. And lo and behold, you know, in 1980, he's murdered, long since out of show business, murdered in Upper Manhattan, the east side of Manhattan, and I heard about this, and I began squirreling away clippings many years later, and I would set it aside. I really started to write the book in earnest around 2008, then set it aside for a decade to write this political trilogy set in Washington, and then went back to it, and fortunately, in time enough to talk to a number of people who had known him and to be able to reconstruct the story as well as I could.
By the way, Hank had a theme song. The sitcom Hank had a theme song with a lyric written by Johnny Mercer. I mean, that's pretty classy.
That was about the only really distinguished thing about the program.
Could you sing the lyric?
The first line of it is, he's up with the sun and he's got the college winging as he goes about another swinging day. And the conceit was that he was constantly doing odd jobs to earn money. He was raising his little sister because their parents were dead. I mean, it was kind of a comic tearjerker in some ways. And there was a tremendous sweetness to the character as well as a lot of gumption. Kallman in real life had plenty of gumption, but I think very little sweetness.
I think people might have caught that first line of the lyric, he's up with the sun. That's where the title of your novel, Up with the Sun, comes from.
Yes.
Yeah. So what kind of research did you do about what it meant to be gay and closeted on Broadway and in Hollywood? You know, one of the obvious differences is, like, on Broadway, so many men traditionally, you know, have been gay, including some of the best, mm-hmm. like, songwriters who ever wrote for Broadway musicals. In Hollywood, I think there was a big gay closeted population, but probably not as big as on Broadway.
Well, you know, I talked to people who had known Kallman and went through any number of hundreds and hundreds of clippings and reviews and everything. And, you know, it was the time when later in the 50s, when he was trying to get a foothold in Hollywood, he would be set up on dates you know, by his agent, dates, needless to say, with young women, and who were sort of aware or not aware that they were really, you know, functioning as beards for this. The lockdown, as you say, you would think of all places, Broadway would be a place where, to a certain extent, you could be yourself. But I don't think that was really very true. I spoke a few years ago to Rita Gardner, who was the original female lead in The Fantastics, which ran for decades and decades off Broadway. And she played the part opposite Kenneth Nelson, who figures in this book. He knew Coleman. Their careers sort of dovetailed each other in some ways for a number of years. And Kenneth Nelson was much beloved by people who worked with him. And Rita told me that, you know, she says, of course I knew Kenny was gay. And sometimes I would see him troubled or down about something. And she says, as amazing as it sounds now, you just couldn't ask. Even in the world of off-Broadway theater, it was just too hot to handle back in those days. And she was remembering this in her 80s, and she was just shaking her head over it.
Well, another thing that closeted actors on Broadway and also in Hollywood had to deal with is the gossip columnists, because they could out you. I don't know if this is a real quote from Earl Wilson, who was a gossip columnist at the New York Post at the time, but in one of his columns he wrote, "Which restaurant chain has been purging its New York branches of swishes?"
Mm-hmm. That's for real.
That's for real.
Yeah. And there would be these obliquely phrased items about people. The gossip columnists had a tremendously hard edge. I remember I was a great reader of the newspaper from the time I was about 7 years old. And I remember writers like Dorothy Kilgallen writing about show business, sometimes writing about politics, too. And there was a hard edge. And if they took a dislike to somebody, they made these nasty little crusades against them. And this was the shame that could not speak its name, let alone the love that could not speak its name. But gossip columnists did find a way of getting it into the papers. For instance, here in Washington, where I live, the Washington Evening Star, a wonderful old paper. If you read it in the 1950s, the only time there's ever an overt mention of homosexuality is when somebody gets arrested.
Thomas Mallon, your novel, Up with the Sun, ends at about the same time that your diary excerpts recently published in The New Yorker begins. And those are your diaries, excerpts of your diaries during the AIDS epidemic, the very early days of it when you were living in Manhattan and so many people you knew had AIDS and were dying or had already died. So let's talk about those diaries. You were in your 30s in the 1980s when mm-hmm. AIDS was first identified and then became an epidemic. Who were you then?
I was an academic who really wanted to be a writer. I taught at Vassar for about a dozen years. I started there in my late 20s. And while I was still there, I moved to New York. I couldn't take living on campus and sort of being part of the college 24/7. So I rented this ancient little walk-up apartment right near Grand Central and began trying to extract myself from academic life. And in some ways, I was living my 20s and my 30s. I even wrote about that somewhere. I was getting some traction as a writer. I was beginning to write a lot of literary journalism. I was starting to write fiction on my own. And I was doing this in a way with very little risk in my life compared to the way most young writers in New York have to operate. I was a tenured professor at this fancy college and then, you know, saw my way out of that. But whereas there was very little risk financially for me, very little risk professionally for me, I was suddenly engulfed in risk that all of my friends were. I was, when it came to romance, I was rather a late bloomer, but not late enough that I wasn't worried that one involvement in particular that I had had would likely render me sick at some point. And we were, my friends and I, we were all beset with anxieties of one kind or another, and had to make decisions and consider contingencies. I remember coming across something in the diary. I was writing a book about plagiarism, and but I desperately wanted to write this second novel, and I was trying to think whether I dared to start the novel, and I thought, no, if I get sick, I'll probably have 2 years left, and I don't want to go out of the world with the two books half written. I'll stick with the book I'm working on now, the plagiarism book, and if I have to die, I will then at least have that book out in the world. And that was how one thought in those days, even while at the same time I was in love with New York. I was in love with the little bit of literary progress I was making. My friends and I were having lives. We were having romance and so forth.
What was it like rereading your diaries to edit them and then publish them? Because, like, you write historical novels, and what was the present to you when you were writing those journals, mm-hmm. that's now the past. That's now history. That's an artifact of a turning point in history. Mm-hmm. So what was it like seeing your life as history?
Strange. It provoked feelings of embarrassment. One's diaries always do that if they have any kind of, I think, authenticity to them. Tremendous feelings of gratitude that I had never gotten sick and that I was here to write all the books that came in between those diaries and today. I was struck, though, by the immediacy of them. With editors at The New Yorker, there was some discussion at some point about my writing a retrospective essay about the time and simply quoting from the diaries, even quoting liberally from them, but situating them in a sort of retrospective point of view. And I argued against this because I thought if the diaries had any value at all, it was their immediacy, the sense that the person writing this did not know what was going to happen,
right.
did not know what it meant yet. And when I reread them after so many years, what struck me immediately was a kind of manic quality to them. There are entries where I am just absolutely slap happy. You know, I'm having my first author photograph taken, or I'm going to some literary party that I never would have expected to be invited to years before. And the next day, all of that will come crashing down because there's been some terrible piece of AIDS news, either in the newspapers or, you know, in my own world. Somebody I knew was sick. And it seemed to me at the time, and the diaries brought this back to me, that I was living in a world where it was always going to be impossible to be happy for very long, that there would be these short bursts. But this looming, terrible destructiveness was always going to be out there.
You know, just a little stray sentence in those diaries was about having a great view of Manhattan when you dined one day at Windows on the World, which was the restaurant on top of the World Trade Center. And a few
yes.
years later, that would be totally demolished in the terrorist attack on 9/11. What was it mm-hmm. like for you to reread that sentence and realize this, like, little factoid tucked away in your journal?
Yes, yeah, certain things.
Part of this, yeah. like, national nightmare.
Yes, these little things that jump out at you and that, you know, you never expected to see. And, of course, at the time you're writing it, you don't think that you could ever reread this and have it mean something completely different from what it appeared to mean to you as you actually wrote the sentence. There are all these things that, you know, one is forgotten. Sometimes the smallest things that you write, the smallest incidents, remarks that you heard, overheard, sometimes those are the things I found in a diary that evoke bigger things much more powerfully than if you had been writing about the big thing directly.
Yeah. During the period that your AIDS diaries cover, the period published in The New Yorker, your boyfriend at the time died of AIDS early in the epidemic. He was 31. you hadn't been seeing each other that long. Were you close enough where you felt like you were the one to take care of him?
No, I mean, I wouldn't say that, but it was a short and very rocky romance. And it had all of the difficulties that any romance can encounter. But at the end, when he was very sick throughout 1984 and he died in October of 1984, at the very end, I became very close to his mother and close really to the rest of his family. And I remember the hospital and the harrowing nature of his illness that went on month after month. This was the time when if you visited somebody with AIDS in the hospital, they practically put you in a hazmat suit. You know, you were wearing masks and gloves and so forth. And nobody knew very much. And this was very early to have that. The gift to me was really his whole family, especially his mother, who remained my friends for decades. And I wound up having Thanksgiving every year with his mother, and I would bring my longtime partner, Bill, to New York. And all of life really is a novel. You just live it instead of writing it, but it always has its odd turns and its strange narrative arcs. But that was a particularly painful time, the time that Tom was still alive and suffering. And I have not really even been able to go back to that diary. The diaries that were excerpted in The New Yorker start in 1985. They run from 85 to 88. And I'm sort of living in the aftermath of that. And I'm probably going to do a book of these diaries for my publisher, Knopf. And I'm going to have to go back to the diaries when Tom was still alive, and that's going to be a hard task for me.
Did you visit him in the hospital, and were you afraid that if you did, you would contract AIDS? Because, as you said, people didn't know yet how it was spread.
I don't remember that fear in the hospital. I remember the fear of a fear that lasted for years that I would contracted simply because of the things we had done together before he was sick. But the atmosphere in the hospital was just dreadful. And there was almost a science fiction aspect to it. One of the sort of themes or one of the plots, if you could use that word, to the diaries that were excerpted in The New Yorker, this is around 1986, 87, was my internal drama, wondering not just whether I was going to get sick or not, but should I have the test? The test was new in those days.
Yeah, you were terrified to have the test.
I was very frightened to have the test. I did not have the test until 1991. At that point, there was really nothing they could do for you. So what was the point of knowing? You already knew how you could protect yourself from infection. You already knew how you could protect others from infection. And if you happened to have the virus, if you were sick, there was very little that they could do for you. Eventually, I mean, there was AZT was the first significant medication, but the side effects of it were absolutely horrific. And so I remember for years, I opted for not knowing.
And what changed your mind in 1991 when you got tested?
Well, I was partnered by that point, and I felt that the likelihood that I was sick was pretty small by that point. It would have manifested itself already in one way or another. So I was, able to do that. But even in those days, in the early 90s, you would get tested and you would wait for 2 weeks for the result, as opposed to, you know, having a pinprick of blood taken from you today and getting the results within less than a minute.
How did it change your life when you knew that you were negative?
It made me feel that I could keep living and keep enjoying my life. There were so many things I loved about my life, even during the worst days of the epidemic in New York, when there was nothing to be done for anybody like Tom or so many of my friends. I absolutely loved my life. I was very driven. I was very hardworking. I was ambitious. I wanted to be a writer. I felt I was getting a late start as a writer. And suddenly things were happening. And I just remember the feeling that I'm not going to have to, maybe until I'm, you know, much older, I'm not going to have to sit down with that diary again and tote up the pros and cons of trying to write a second book while I'm writing a first one, because I might not be around to finish them within a couple of years.
So you were so relieved to know that your death was not imminent. You're 71 now. Have mm-hmm. your thoughts about aging been affected by how afraid you were that you were going to die in your 30s?
I think it would be impossible for those thoughts and feelings not to have been affected. I am so aware of how lucky I was. And I've enjoyed rude good health for almost my whole life. I'd like that to continue for a while. But I like to think that, you know, when things fall apart, that I'll be able to accept that with a certain amount of greater grace, because I know that it could so easily, all of those intervening decades could so easily have been denied to me by life. And I don't know, that'll be a test of my character, I guess, when it comes.
Yeah. In your latest novel, Up with the Sun, one of the characters says, "All my life I've loved the past as a place that can keep you safe from the present, an inert world sleeping and finished that can't push you around, a place that your imagination can make as pretty as the two-dimensional flats on a Broadway set." Is that a sentiment you share, and is that one of the reasons why you write historical fiction?
Yes, I think so. I think that's me speaking through Matt, my fictional pianist in Up with the Sun. I think that's always been a theme in my books. I wrote a novel many years ago called Dewey Defeats Truman, which was all set during the summer and fall of 1948 in a little town in Michigan that had been Thomas E. Dewey's hometown. And there's an old man in that book named Horace Sinclair. And he expresses a lot of my preference for the past, the idea that the past is the present perfected, somehow put in amber, somehow an easier place to live in. He's the one who says, you know, some people, when they pass a house, when they're walking on the street, they wonder who lives there. And he, when he walks past the house, always wonders who used to live there.
Thomas Mallon, a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Same here. Thank you, Terry.
Thomas Mallon speaking to Terry Gross in 2023. His new book is called The Very Heart of It, New York Diaries, 1983 to 1994.